Chapter 2, Tools of the Trade. First we build the tools, then they build us. Marshall McLuhan. Thought police on her tail, Michelle launched straight into the fray. First stop was Rob Trucks of Spin Magazine. She told him that the conversation at Yoshi's went great. She said, it went great the whole time. Rob said he didn't think so, but Michelle insisted that she got what she wanted, which was basically a whole lot of disrupting the disruptors. It was only one day after the event at Yoshi's, and Michelle came across as surprisingly unconcerned and unruffled. She talked in general about the effect that bootlegging has had on her ability to perform, and explained sadly, I really liked having an authentic dialogue with my audience. It's been stolen from me, and I don't have any reason to believe that I'll ever get it back. But if I'm going to be held captive by social media, I'm going to use it against itself. In regard to the previous night, she explained that even though there was a lot of talk, the quiet voices hadn't chimed in yet. She said, the loudest voices are pretty convinced that they're going to dominate the conversation and triumph by dominating the conversation, but they are not going to have the last word. From my perspective, though, the loudest voices were all I could hear. Within 3 days, all of Michelle's gigs had been systematically targeted, one after another, venues folded under pressure from the growing mob. John Becker took credit for shutting down the gigs with a Change.org petition with approximately 4,000 unverified signatures in 3 days. Signers didn't seem to notice that among other inaccuracies, he listed Phyllis Stein as Michelle's manager and asked her to cancel the tour. The Phyllis Stein didn't respond because, well, think about it. I missed both the Spin article and the Change.org petition. My online searches only turned up the same story in the same words over and over again. It didn't occur to me to look on Twitter, and Michelle's Facebook page was becoming a rant fest. Not knowing where else to start, I listened to the 23-minute audio bootleg. I could hear one, maybe two hecklers in the audience, and others asking them to be quiet and let her talk. I heard Michelle grow more and more frustrated, and finally, in a burst of anger, respond to the loudest voice, and then they took the microphone away. Let me repeat that. They took the microphone away. Take a listen. Audience, referring to the heckler. Get her out of here! Yoshi's. Yeah, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us tonight at Yoshi's. Michelle. You're pulling the plug? They're giving me the hook, y'all. Audience. Hell no! Hell no! Michelle. I still got game. I still got game. Audience. You don't need no amplifier. Michelle, shall we lose the mic? Yoshi's, yeah. Audience, continue. Michelle, all right, I will. Scattered applause, stage sounds. Let's move closer. When they take away the microphone, you want to stay close. Drama, much ado about what? Twitter? Jesus? God? Gays going to hell? Reality? I heard her say, you said you wanted reality. I couldn't see the signs on the stage, and I had no idea that there was any more to the conversation than what I had heard. But I knew something was missing. What else could I do but follow the breadcrumb trail? Frustrated and expecting an easy answer, I tuned into a talk show I'd never heard of, Nicole Sandler's Radio or Not. Sandler had claimed in a tweet, "My agenda is to give her a fair shake to explain what she was trying to say without yelling or shutting her down." However, after listening to a couple of Sandler's previous shows, I was surprised that Michelle had chosen this venue. When the show started, I was even more surprised. The issue quickly changed from Michelle explaining herself to a baffling tug of war between her and Nicole about whether the program was live or podcast, subject to manipulation because of a significant on-air delay of the broadcast. This breach of trust pretty much sealed the deal on whether or not Nicole would get the exclusive interview she had expected. Michelle had agreed to the interview on certain terms: live broadcast, no recording. However, when the interview started, a third voice chimed in, that of Nicole's producer, on a separate line. While Michelle waited for Nicole's questions, the producer peppered her with questions designed to agitate her and ensure that she was off balance for the interview. The radio audience could not hear the third person talking. Instead, they only heard Michelle inexplicably refusing this toxic microphone. Nicole had been certain Michelle would be so intent on explaining herself that she would allow any kind of media manipulation to occur. Nope. Michelle spent her part of the conversation nonchalantly counting the seconds in the delay between when she spoke and when she heard the transmission. Once she had established that there was an approximately 20-second delay, she hung up. Nicole, frustrated with Michelle's recalcitrance, gave vent to her anger, yelling, "Pick up the fucking phone, Michelle!" Michelle ignored her profane pleas and responded in real time via Twitter. These were the terms Michelle had negotiated prior to the broadcast, and it was not news to Nicole. Later, Michelle explained that Nicole had formerly been a solid program director and disc jockey who had nurtured strong relationships with musicians over her 25-year career. But when Clear Channel gobbled up her previous rock and roll station, she had seen the writing on the wall. She was among the first to actively move from radio to digital as a way to hang on to her hard-won, loyal audience. Now she was stuck spinning sensation and sound bites and engaging in high drama just to get ratings, just to make a living. She had to provide more snark and less substance regularly. Michelle was not sympathetic. In fact, she scorned such media hounds as Podcast Strata. Sandler's only mode of communication now was the same as everyone else's. No exclusive interview to be had, and at a complete loss for words, she fumed in exasperation, "I am not going to read your tweets over the air, Michelle." Fine. It was obvious that if I wanted to know what was going on, I had to get on Twitter. Not realizing that I could simply lurk, I created an account, choosing the name @FreeStateKansas for my handle and a painting of The Prodigal Son by Aaron Douglas as my avatar. Little did I know that I had just entered into a very antisocial world, the land of social media. Sure, I'd had Facebook for years, but I'd stayed away from Twitter because it seemed too trendy and kind of creepy. Suddenly, I had access to thousands of people, celebrities, politicians, poets, and the most prosaic of writers, all swimming in the same tank. When I arrived, Michelle had a score sheet going. Truth, 10. Reality, 13. And she said the show would run from 8 to 11 Pacific Standard Time, Monday through Friday. What the hell was she up to? Did she really need 15 hours a week to clarify the situation? She seemed happy to have us all conversing, and even happier if she could set the loudest voices on each other. Kind of a bugs in a jar situation. Personalities emerged. One stalwart supporter was Jamito Conchito, a gay man whose profile boasted a picture of himself wearing Michelle Shock's Captain Swing t-shirt and his fist raised. An entertainment writer named Chris Willman stalked us all in broad daylight using both his professional journalist handle, at Chris Willman, and anonymous troll handles, at George's brother and at Jiminy Croquet. Curious gawkers asked questions and left befuddled. Trolls gathered under digital bridges. One unfortunate fellow, dubbed JBC, spent most of his time creating new accounts to replace suspended ones and screaming alternating support and attack in all caps until pretty much everyone had bonded in their desire to see the poor soul tweet his last. There was a lot of yelling. Michelle referred to those who trolled her as gnats. I liked how the label turned them into pesky little squishables whose only power seemed to lie in obscuring one's vision periodically. The gnats called anyone who took her side sycophants, but we preferred to call ourselves poets. Each day had a theme. Monday was marriage equality versus topics such as income inequality, immigration reform, foreclosure, basically anything that affects the 99%. Tuesday's topic was big data versus IP. Wednesday centered on free speech versus censorship. And Thursday was faith versus atheism. But my favorite day was Friday, poets versus gnats. On Fridays, the room grew quiet because even the gnats were expected to rhyme. One day, we conversed entirely in iambic pentameter. One day, limericks. I brought my favorites, T.S. Eliot, W.B. Yeats, Dr. Seuss. Michelle introduced me to Diane DePrima and Anne Waldman. She posted verse from John O'Donohue, who explained it all with a few words. The media wraps everything in a cellophane of sound, and the ghost surface of the virtual overlays the breathing earth. The industry of distraction makes us forget that we live in a universe. To which Allen Ginsberg replied, America, when will you be angelic? When will you take off your clothes? When will you look at yourself through the grave? And Yeats warned, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. The poets included a gay man, a transgender woman, a surfer dude, and me. People kept asking me what Michelle meant, why she continued to say things that upset people. I didn't know. None of us really did, but we defended her right to be heard. The gnats swarmed. We were soon outnumbered by what Michelle called the dirty two dozen, which caused us to dig in even more. There were a few in the pack who had reason to include themselves in the conversation, but most didn't even know who Michelle was. They didn't know her history of radical protest or her music. The majority of them pretended to defend LGBT rights, but turned out to be straight guys with multiple accounts and misogynist agendas. One daily antagonist was at St. Shocked, whose parody account consisted of thousands of clever tweets such as these. Does anyone know how to get lamb's blood out of rayon? What a friend we have in Jesus. Oh, Christ, what a pal. Bring me the foreskins of 100 pro homos, then we'll talk. Have I mentioned lately Big Data ate my baby? Has Big Data ordered you to pretend Bradley Manning doesn't exist? And when I say you people, you know which people I'm talking about, pro homo. But the more they demanded that Michelle explain herself, the more birds she flipped. The more people in the room, the less anyone learned. Twitter. Do I need to remind you that we were doing all of this on Twitter? Trying to find truth in this melee was like trying to find a fortune cookie in a ticker tape parade. And this is where Michelle chose to go to find her voice. Some days were really ugly, and I knew that the insults were taking a toll. Online social mobbing has a tangible effect, something similar to PTSD. Even when the insults are specious, there's a darkness to the process that makes Lord of the Flies look like child's play. To combat the viciousness, Michelle joked and laughed in incredulity, but her sarcasm and puns went largely unappreciated. Like many others, I didn't understand why she continued to fight. It hurt to watch. I'm sure it hurt even more to endure. At a loss for what to do, I started collecting screenshot samples of the venom, maybe to inoculate us all against the poisonous effect. It was high drama. Sometimes the conversation became a poetic dance, other times an intense inquisition where forces aligned and virtual stones were cast with abandon. Fools rushed in. Angels took cover. The exchanges were fast and furious, and Michelle did all the wrong things. She fought back. She refused to answer simple questions. She frustrated even the most earnest of inquisitors. She watched as her attackers became bored and then found ways to inspire their wrath once again. She let herself get mobbed. I didn't dare suggest that she give up. Instead, I asked what the point was. Why galvanize the trolls? Why not just walk away? What was a nice girl like her doing in a hellhole like this? Talking to grown men masquerading as 20-year-old girls like Anna Kay, who tweeted, "Hey Michelle, I offered to converse with you directly, but you were too cowardly to do so, so shut the fuck up." Surely she could find more respectful interviewers. Something about Twitter taps into the ugliest and most dysfunctional elements of human nature. Context is a lost cause, and the whole place is filthy with trolls. Everyone's voice is presented equally without regard for how many times they've spoken or whether the general conversation has already covered that topic. You have no idea how many people are listening or who you're talking to. It was the perfect demonstration of an imperfect microphone. The whole situation was fun and frustrating at the same time. Every time Michelle would get in a heated discussion, someone would take a screenshot of something she said, rip it out of context, and repost it. The floor became littered with these tiny metaphors for what happened at Yoshi's, and the air was thick with pun and punishment. No holds were barred in regard to her private life either. When Michelle announced that she had bought tickets and was looking forward to seeing her favorite God-hater, Sarah Silverman, at Cafe Largo, the Nat Gang called ahead to warn them that Michelle and her friends planned to disrupt Sarah's show, and they were bounced at the door. So instead, Michelle and Twitter pals Quad and Head the Honest headed over to Villain's Tavern, where the Americana ensemble, L.A. Hootenanny, invited Michelle up on stage to sing with them. She joined the jam, and the dance floor was rocking. The next day, Kevin Mapisek Marasek mounted a campaign to call that venue and any others in the LA area that might make the politically incorrect mistake of allowing Michelle to play. He reported his success on Twitter, saying, "I can confirm the Mint and Liquid Kitty are emphatic about not booking her, and Villains won't allow her back." Note that there are three Nats who favorited this tweet, at least two of which are Kevin's anonymous accounts. Dana DiArmond, a porn star who lived in the same building, snapped this photo of Michelle during her daily swim prayer time and posted it on Twitter with the message, "I'm going to drown Michelle shocked. Don't tell the police. Okay, thanks." One Nat repeatedly accused Michelle of racism when she exclaimed, a tweet from Michelle shocked, "Oh my God, I never realized a lynching could be so much fun." But it struck Twitter friend Thomas Dunning as a Monty Python-style witch trial. He tweeted, "Anna, any queer with two brain cells has realized by now that we were fed a witch for hunting. Why so hungry?" The meanest thing we poets were accused of was creating an art project. Patton Oswalt became our hero du jour when he posted sets of tweets that were meant to be taken out of context unless the reader saw both tweets together. The first tweet says, "These idiots who deny that clumsy change is real and a pressing threat are no different from misogynists who claim that." And the second tweet reads, "Women enjoy rape. Grow the fuck up, all of you." Amid the chaos, I sorted out two types of fiends, those seeking money and those seeking attention. I'll refer to the former as pro-trolls. Professional trolls. You have to understand that everything that happens in real life happens on Twitter. Money changes hands in more ways than you can imagine. Ever heard of Bitcoin? Cryptocurrency? You will. Did you know that a single tweet from a celebrity can earn them up to $20,000? That's the average price tag when Khloe Kardashian shouts out to her 18 million followers. Even Bob Vila clocks in with $910 per tweet, and he only has about 1 million followers. Don't believe me? Check IZEA Social Media Marketing. Check Adly. To understand how people make money on Twitter, consider the free advertising that occurs when an account collects a lot of followers. Then imagine what products might be provided. I'll use Gramps Cramps as an example. Gramps is actually a network of accounts that are connected by tag words relating to anything "God hates fags" or "Phelps." One of Gramps' followers is Herbalicious, who has a number of manifestations as well. Professional trolls like Gramps also create fake or mock celebrity accounts to incite anger and attract more followers. Most of these sites are just repost mills. To increase their clout score, they follow hot topics and celebrities or sites that offer automatic followback and automatic repost services. If you look at their followers, you will see the products pervade. They start as egg accounts that pass time in the incubator until they are old enough to slip past spam bots and become baby trolls. So if you see a nest of eggs, each with only two or three followers, you might want to grab a can of Raid. Some grow up to be nice. They post images of unicorns and rainbows and puppies. Some are not nice. They post pictures of penises and rats. But they're all after the same thing: your click. Unprofessional trolls. By unprofessional, I mean amateur. These trollish wannabes mimic professional troll behavior, but they probably have a day job. They're not making money yet. They're just in it for the lulls. They just want to piss you off. In the old world, if you wrote abusive letters to a person or spread lies about them, or if you threatened their livelihood with a smear campaign, eventually those letters would be traced to you and you would be held accountable. Not so in the age of social media. While we are all de facto publishers, none of us really expect to be held to journalistic standards. Case in point is Kevin Marasek's troll account, Anna K., who gleefully continues the cyber attack on Michelle's prospective venues and here even attempts to negotiate for the microphone. Anna K. Any club or venue that tries to book M. Schacht will be met with protests and boycotts. She's finished as a musician. You delete your two accounts forever, and I'll delete mine forever. No more Twitter. You get rid of me, and I get rid of you. The simple act of a few guys creating multiple accounts effectively hijacks the conversation and delivers a rush of power to the trolls. The analog equivalent would be listening in on the old-fashioned party line and then yelling your opinion into the mouthpiece, except you're anonymous. Let's see how it works. Here, an unsuspecting artist, Say Adams, happily tweets that he has just met Michelle. Check out what happens. Say Adams tweets to Michelle. Had a great conversation with Michelle Schacht at Corey Helford in L.A., supporting artists Risk and Nathan Oda. Tequia replies, "This is the former manager of Michelle Schacht and the person that just tweeted you." Tequia includes a screenshot of a tweet from Michelangelo Dav, also known as JBC, that says, "What did you say, nigger jigaboo, you black ass? Get back on my plantation so I can whip you to blood. Your mama suck my dicky, faggot." For the record, then, tweets under the handle of @BrandoRuled, and her biggest supporter to boot. She's encouraged him in the past. Really unwell lady. Here it is again. Chuck Prophet tweets, "Nobody remembers Lyndon LaRouche, but Michelle Schacht does." JBC replies, "I remember LaRouche, brother. Lyndon Johnson. Come on, Chuck. Isn't it time to forgive Michelle Schacht by now? Time heals all wounds." Chuck, "I'm down with the girl. Have been from day one." Lori Everard tweets, "Really? Are you down with homophobia and racism, too? Michelle Schacht is." Chuck, "Were you there?" Posting and reposting knee-jerkiness just proves the internet is the gayest thing of all. Anna Kay chimes in, "Oh, look, another false prophet. Save us all from your ignorance and stop defending a racist gay-bashing has-been." These exchanges were not the exception. Even after Michelle's harshest critics admitted that what she said at Yoshi's was probably not intended as hate speech, the name-calling continued consistently over the entire year. Diane Griffin tweets, "It's not that you call her a racist. It's that you never stop calling her names." Amid the chaos, Michelle tried to set the record straight several times with tweets like these. "Thanks for keeping an open mind. Am neither against a woman's right to choose nor gay marriage. Am a fundamentalist, though." And in response to the question, "What's your beef with homosexuality?" she replied, "Nothing, nothing at all. I love me some gays. It's the proxies I can't stand." But her voice was drowned out, and not surprisingly, the mobbing continued apace. The more Michelle said, the more concentrated the attacks. Dr. Janice Harper is an expert on this topic, but she said that what went on with Michelle was not a textbook case of mobbing. Harper is a cultural anthropologist who wrote about her own experience in Mobbed, a survival guide to adult bullying and mobbing. I talked to her at length about Michelle's situation, and she said that while Michelle was mobbed in the beginning, she didn't respond the way most mobbing victims do. She said most victims want two things. They want the mobbing to stop, and they want to be heard. Her advice was similar to what rape victims are told. If it looks like they're going to destroy you, don't fight back. It only makes them abuse you more. Get to a safe place, tell the authorities, file a lawsuit if you can, admit your own part in the conflict, and start the healing process as soon as possible. Michelle wasn't having any of that. It struck me as I listened to Dr. Harper tell her story that there might be an element of misogyny in the mobbing phenomenon. I asked her if she thought mobbing seemed to happen more to women, and she said, absolutely. Her own story is worth a detour. She was up for tenure at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and, well, sometimes things get nasty in academia. It's funny now, but by the time the NSA finally determined that Dr. Harper was not, in fact, creating an H-bomb in her spare time, or kicking puppies around in the alley with a meth addict, she had shouted herself hoarse and alienated and exposed way too many people. She ultimately won her lawsuit, but lost her career and reputation, along with the trust of many close friends. Her advice from Michelle was to quiet down and keep still. But rather than try to make peace, Michelle responded to the daily attacks with true punk panache, refusing to take the apology route and smacking away an easy redemption by tweeting about promos and Gestapo, which she blamed for the media's overreaction to her attempt to confound and disrupt the turgid rectitude that threatened to keep the necessary conversation from ever taking place. She wasn't easy to follow, but she was very entertaining. She took on every rock-throwing yahoo on Twitter. Even those of us who wanted to help her were confused by her tactics. It seemed like just as we dug her out of the rubble and dusted her off, she set off another blast that brought more rocks hammering down on our heads. Dr. Harper claims that fighting in this situation is useless because the mobbers do not want answers to their questions. They don't want resolution. They aren't listening, and they make any intelligent conversation impossible. Daily tweets such as this illustrate her point. Who could even like Michelle Schacht anymore? Her repulsive ugliness does nothing to help the universe. As hard as it was to hear, it was even harder to listen. So after 4 months of daily argument, Michelle's top defenders simply gave up. We walked away, one by one, from the person we had sworn to protect. She said she'd expected it and told us we were welcome to stay or go, but she had to stay. Echoes of what she said the first night I ever heard her sing. When we ended the Daily Show 4 months after it began, we tried to make it fun, turning our characters into Shakespearean fools for the morning and clowning around. We evoked Paul Krasner and George Carlin. We even conjured up Mickey Rooney's Puck. We rode off into the sunset, laughing our tails off. But when the curtain came down, I was worried. We were able to leave, but she wasn't. Over a year later, you can still find a handful of antagonists who continue posting, convinced that they can convince Michelle to shut up. They chant, "Love wins" and "No hate" at appropriate intervals. They don't even suggest anymore that she shut up and sing. No, they just want her to shut up. Anna Kay tweets, "Do you not get how fucking stupid you appear when you publicly post you've been censored? Are you that brainless?" Michelle Schacht tweets, "I've been censored. Censored, but not silenced." The shame of this whole thing, Michelle said in the end, was the fact that so many people believed the lies.